Public Information Council, this is being held under the State Open Meeting Act. Proper notices have been posted according to that. And before we get started, I would like for everyone to join me with the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you. Our routine is that we go around the room and introduce who we are and what outfit we represent here today. And we're going to start with Mike up here.
Mike Sexton, Oklahoma Department of Commerce.
Kathy Hines, Center for Special Analysis.
Alan Janis of EWC.
Jay Evans, Department of Transportation.
Mike Shagru, Water Resources Board.
Kim Carter, Oklahoma Office of Homeland Security.
Mike Sharp, Conservation Commission.
Jane Weber, Oklahoma Geological Survey.
Troy Frazier, Oklahoma Tax Commission.
David Clark, Oklahoma Department of Agriculture, Food and Forestry.
Michael Larson, Office of State Government.
Amy Britt, Department of Environmental Quality.
Dick Clark, Office of State Finance.
Charles Brady, City of Ardmore.
Dan Huff, Oklahoma Biological Survey.
Shelley Willoughby, Office of Geographic Information.
Scott March, Center for Spatial Analysis.
Jennifer Spencer, OSU.
Stacey Canada, ESRI.
Jared Smith, USGS.
Darrell Williams, USGS.
Billy McPherson, Center for Spatial Analysis.
Robert Rye, Oklahoma Office of Homeland Security.
Brenda Fennell, Choctaw Nation, Environmental Office.
Susan Langley, Department of Agriculture, Food and Forestry.
Sergeant David Davis, Oklahoma Military Department.
Gail Hutchcock, Osage County Assessor.
John Phillips, Water Board.
Angie Lee, Clayton County.
Sam Woodward, Jeff.
Mike Sexton, Water Board.
Okay, well, thank everyone for being here. If you didn't get a chance to sign in on the sheet, please do so. That way we can keep you informed of the activities of the council. We do have a quorum, so next item is approval of our January meeting minutes. Since we didn't have a chance to meet in February, the weather kind of got us off of that deal. Does anyone have any corrections on the minutes?
Motion to approve.
Here, second.
Second.
Motion been made and seconded. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor of approval, please say aye.
Aye.
Those same sign if you don't. Motion carried. Committee reports. We've got a couple of committees still out working. Land cover, Dan, do you have anything to report?
Yes, I do. The land cover work group met on January 31st, so we did dodge the weather there somehow. We had a good meeting. Discussed several things. Don Sawinski of the Chickasaw Nation was able to come to the meeting and thought they were very interested in what we were doing and encouraged us to send her a proposal to do some work, to do some of the preliminary work in the Chickasaw Nation area. So we've been working on that. We also had a report. We do now have the four band name data available. John McGowes group, Chamber of Viridar, did some preliminary work on that and found out that the fourth band was taken by a different camera than the other three, so there's a little bit of, it's not quite as easy to use as we had hoped, but I think they're waiting around for that and they're working on that as well. So we're hoping to get something to the Chickasaw Nation so we can get some preliminary work done over the summer. We talked to her some more, got things. Thank you. We also talked about some other data, including a program called Worldview, which might also have some data that we can use. So, and in addition to that, we did the biological survey did have a booth at the GIS State of Capitol, and we did have some information on the land cover work group. Hopefully we'll get something going here in the near future.
Okay. Does anybody have any questions for you? Thank you. Amy, you have anything on you?
We haven't met since the last meeting, so whether or not we're going to, I think we thought we'd schedule a meeting environmental GIS data to get them to be on the conference.
All right. Next item. I want to take a look at addressing standards for the council to look at that issue. This is something that we haven't, as a council, looked at. I know there's been some work done in the past. Charles, I think you've been involved with some of that. Some work done back probably around 2003, something like that, on some grant work on a pilot project. Does that sound right, Mary? I mean, Kathy?
That project that I'm thinking of was like 2005, 2006. But
I don't remember. I remember it was a long time ago, and it kind of went nowhere.
I looked. I couldn't find it.
I didn't have any notes on mine either.
Yeah, I looked in Mary's old email and I couldn't find anything in there, so I have no idea.
Okay. Well, at any rate, I think this is something that we need to look into as a state, because more and more databases are being developed with addresses in them. And I think we need to come up with some sort of standard that we can all work with as we go forward to build these databases.
So is there a national standard we can just use?
Yes, there is. One of the things that really kind of got me thinking about this is there's a bill going through the Senate, Senate Bill 411, that's asking the Insurance Department and the Department of Health to develop a comprehensive health care information system. And I can see that being, you know, a great application for a mapping type application. There's going to be a lot of addressing the people that supply health care stuff and where people live and that sort of thing. So I thought if we could come up with a standard that we could advise them on how they could go about building this database with regards to addresses would be helpful. Back in, I think it was in January, the FGDC has a draft of what they call a thoroughfare, landmark, and postal address data standard that they've been working on. This has been developed in conjunction with ERISA and NENA, the National Emergency Number Association. So, to me, those are two people that have been working in this field for many years, and are, to me, I would call them experts in this area. And I thought this might be something that we ought to look at. And so, what I'd like to do is more work with the people that have interest in this and some experience to sit down, take a look at this, look at what's been done, if you've some experience working with addresses, and see what you can come back to the council and give us some advice. So Health over at Health has said he would help. You know, Katie Rich was at Health, and she was very involved in geocoding and address management, and now she's over at Chesapeake, but she said she would work with us as much as she could on her knowledge of that area. So, and we sure solicit any volunteers from the audience or the council, or if you have somebody back in your shop, it would be good to just let Shelly or I know, and we can get this group together and take a look. It's a big effort. Addresses are a big thing, very important. Thought it might be time that we start.
Well, see, that's the thing. Through contracts with OU, some of the state agencies have made an effort to try to work these databases together with common formats and such. So, it's an issue.
There's some experience out there actually doing it, so that's good.
Do you see this as being a point-based or a point-based address database, or based on roads, client, vector?
I don't know what they're going to be looking at. I think this standard that FGDC's come up with will address all those.
Well, as far as addresses, I mean, I've only done address, tried to do geocoding once, and that was several years ago, and I got like a 10-15% match rate on our data. But, I mean, that brings up the very issue that I think that is far as geocoding is concerned, is people who have actually done a lot of geocoding would be the ones to participate in this. So, just from my perspective, would be just getting addresses in there that are matchable, that are address matchable. So when you put them in, you come back with an address matching system. You come back with something that will, you know, a point that's close where it ought to be.
How do the 911 systems?
This is an area I'm not really familiar with.
That's the problem. USGS came up, or through the Census Bureau, came up with an addressing scheme with field names like FE name, address one left, address left two, address left from, address right from, address right to, and such. And then the 911 folks got involved. At the county 911 level, the field names are different. And then, if I remember correctly, Census Bureau, they're changing some of their schemes and some of their codes and stuff. And then you've got national standards that have already been set for the Streamlined Sales Tax Initiative. And then you've got individual standards for software, like for the election board and what we're doing. And everything's across the board. And it's literally just across the board. The names don't match. The field characteristics don't necessarily match. It's just a mess.
I saw in the new 2009 line work that what you're saying about the attribute fields are completely different than how it was in the old standard Tiger.
They put the names together too. They don't have the pieces anymore. They put it all into one field, which I think is a mistake. But.
And according to FGDC, I think the Census Bureau is going to be the custodian of this, kind of the one that manages this standard. That's if it's ever approved.
Whatever happened to the U.S. Postal Service standard?
Well, that's incorporated in here. Yeah. From what I gather, just what little bit I've read, the thing's 555 pages long. Try to get your head around it or something else.
And see, Kathy's group, they get a quarterly update of that for the entire state, so they can see it on a regular basis.
Monthly.
I know when we set up the 911 for Garfield County, that was the first thing we did is we went to the Postal Service because everything was zip code oriented, and then we built a grid from there. So, yeah, the Postal Service is still, I think, going to be paramount.
Supposedly that's been rolled up into this new standard. I don't know. That's what I'd like for a group of people to look at and come back and give us some advice. And what do we do? I mean, to do nothing, I don't think is what we need to be doing.
Does it make sense for us as a state to try to come up with standards? Because ultimately, won't it be federal standards that come into play and that are the actual standards?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, if we go out and make our own standards, of course, I just already said a while ago that, you know, we need to work with the national standards for who they are. So, yeah, your point is well made, that we don't want to just make up our own.
That's been the problem. Everybody makes up their own up till now. This appears to be a national standard, is what they're coming up with. And so, you want to adopt it. You try to build things from here on out. That would seem logical.
Once they finalize.
Well, supposedly it's the final draft. So, you know, whatever it has to go through as far as approval through the red tape and FGDC. I don't know, Daryl, do you have any insight on what it takes to get a standard approved through that system?
I don't have any insight, but I know it takes a long time, a very long time. So I'm just thinking what you would want the committee to define, you know, all of the discussion you're having, you define what you have to tell the committee what the objectives are. You know, if it's to go out and determine. Right now, it's just too many questions to be answered.
Well, I think we need to take a look at this supposedly proposed national standard and see if it's something that we could live with. Yeah, that's really going, you know, in light of what we've been doing.
Well, you may recall too, Mike, that initially when we started the mapping project, the broadband mapping project, NTIA was going to have us collect information at the address level, and then they backed off on that. Well, in that initial set of documents that they sent us, they had the format that they wanted the addresses in and so forth. I didn't study it that closely, but it was probably close to the U.S. Postal Service format. But then they backed off and said, no, we don't want to collect data at the address level, so we haven't done that. At one point, we were going to be collecting that data and also having the you know, geographic coordinates of each address.
Yes. I dug back in my emails last summer when we were working on this with broadband, and I found one from May where she was interested in actually building a state-level address database. She was going to look into that to see, I think, if she could put together a proposal and maybe get some funding for that. I never did hear anything back from her, so I assume that that just never did materialize. But anyway, if anyone's interested in working on this thing, let Shelley or I know, we'll put the group together and we'll be able to look at this. Let's see where it goes.
I'd be glad to sit on that.
Okay.
We're volunteers too.
Yes. All right.
I did too.
Okay. All right. The next deal. You all, I'm sure, are fully aware of what's going on at the state level as far as IT consolidation and that effort, which affects state agencies, actually affects appropriated state agencies. Kathy, you guys are exempted out, higher ed, and OneNet's exempted out. I heard Wednesday from Alex Pettit that it sounds like the legislature is going to exempt themselves out, which, you know, that's horrible.
Oh, wow.
You know, when you read the language in that bill that's going through in House Bill 1504, it's pretty scary because, at least for state employees that have any kind of an IT job description or duties, which I think back in January, Shelley reported that we got all of our GIS job descriptions.
I've already got people in my shop going, you know, I don't think I want it now.
Yeah.
All the work, and now people are like, oh,
yeah. Yeah, they're all classified in the IT classification system. So, under the, if you read the legislation word for word, it basically takes all those people that fall into those job classifications and put them under the umbrella of the Information Service Division, or OSA. Okay. But my take is that the way Mr. Pettit is looking at this organization, reorganization, is not to just yank everybody out of agencies and put them over in where Dick's located. He's wanting to look at what the individual agency needs are and leave people in place that do that, try to look at services that are similar services that different agencies use so that we can put those into a what they call a shared service type of a category, so that you know, there, it's a service that's provided to agencies that need it, and you know, you can see some efficiencies that occur in that. So I don't think it's going to be as scary as it sounds, but there's a lot of uncertainty. You know, I don't know how it's going to be. We're just going to have to see, but I think the bottom line is it's going to happen. Legislature is behind this. The governor is pushing it hard. It's a House bill. It's made it through the House. It's over in the Senate. It could change. It could go away. It could not happen. But my feeling is that it is going to happen. So, what do we do? I don't know how we address that change. And if you think back to our meeting in November when Mr. Pettit was here and made his presentation, basically told us to come up with our own idea of how we should be governed. So, what I've done, I've put together a little PowerPoint to kind of go over some of these things and throw something out just as a something to be chewing on. It's not anything that has to be done. Just something for everybody to kind of give us a starting point, if you will, dealing with this whole issue of governance. I don't know about you, but I've had a hard time getting my head around what all this means because I'm not used to thinking about these sort of things. I'm a project-oriented kind of guy. I'm just going to be out in the field doing work, trying to put pieces together like this. But it's necessary. I think it's a necessary function in government to be thinking about how we can handle all these resources in the most efficient and effective way. And a phrase that I ran across, this came out of one of the presentations that Mr. Pettit was using in the governance workshop that he did for his CIOs and IT directors. And it makes sense to me. You know, governance is about the right people making the right decisions in the right areas. Back in January, I said I was going to set up this wiki. Alex is really into these wikis to communicate and kind of like a blog, if you will. And so I set one up for the council. Then I got to thinking, you know, to get everybody on that wiki, it's no different than having an open meeting with everybody, you know. Attorney said, hey, what do you think about here? So I haven't invited anybody to be on the wiki because there's 12 state agencies on this council, and if we all get together, we are holding a meeting. So we don't want to be in violation of the open meeting. So we're not going to go there. We're going to do this thing out in open, transparent government. That's what it's all about anyway, right? So why do we want to do governance? Well, we want to maximize desirable business outcomes through the efficient, effective use of technology, in our case, GIS. The value of GIS lies in the outcome of the business process that you're seeking. It's not in GIS technology alone. It's hard to sit down and just make a business case for GIS. Say, oh, I want a system that will make these pretty maps and do this and that. Well, why? Why do you want to do that? Well, you want to do something to improve whatever it is that you're doing. You want to make better decisions. You want to, you know, have more output of something. You want to do something different that you've never done before. You want to, you leverage this technology, whether it's IT, in our case, GIS leverages IT resources to get the job done. So that's really what this is all about, is looking at what an agency does in their business, and we use this technology to make that outcome more desirable or whatever. So now, thinking through this thing, we've really been talking about two levels or two types of governance here. This restructuring IT consolidation thing is more kind of like looking at how we overall manage our resources through an enterprise type relationship. And then there's this other level of governance where we talk about data. How do we handle data? How do we manage the life cycle of data from being created all the way through maintenance and back around? And they're kind of two different things in my mind. And for the council, those articles that I sent out to you, the Minnesota plan, it pretty much looks at the big picture, where we're looking at the organization and how it's formed and how it works with others. Then the Colorado plan, they're particularly talking about how they manage their data through stewardship. Of course, we've talked about that in the past here, about the need for stewards, data stewards, and we have one in the Water Resources Board on our National Hydrology Data Center, but there's a lot more of that we, as a council, need to be doing. Because after all, the council is the one that actually, is in charge of it. You look at the present state of governance in the state, we've got some statutes that deal with that. We've got the council that's set up, and responsibilities, it's charged with development, adoption, and recommendation of standards for data. That's pretty good. Development of a strategy for implementing a statewide GIS. statewide geographic information plan, you know, those kind of things. We've got an Office of Geographic Information out here that, to support the operation of the council. Establish statewide clearinghouse, coordinate multi-agency projects, you know, those kind of things. And then we've got the state agencies down here that, you know, y'all have your own individual GIS programs. So how do we put all this together in this framework of IT consolidation that's going around? I swiped this out of Alex's presentation for the last call, so kind of explains what this federated concept is, where you've got down here in this layer, you've got the basic things that you do. In IT, for example, you might think about the network that's out here that we connect to, servers, you know, provide, you know, storage for data, those kind of things. You move up here in the shared business services area. Those of you in state government, you might be familiar with the word CORE, the thing that keeps track of all of our payroll and all that. It's a shared service item. And then we've got, you know, 132 agencies down here that, you know, have specific business processes that they do. They're unique to what they do in a lot of cases. You know, even when you think about water quality, there are certain things that they do at the water board, certain things they do over at DEQ, certain things they do at the conservation commission. So we have specific things and functions that we do. The question is, are there some common things that we can do that could move up here into this shared service area, for example? Well, let's see. Let's unpack this a little bit and take a look at each layer at a time in regard to, you know, GIS functions. These utility functions, we might want to throw into this, you know, centralized technology layer, if you will. What we have with regard to baseline data, imagery, or elevation, boundaries, there's probably some other things that go in there. Obviously, these things are going to require stewardship, somebody that maintains those things to keep track of. But these are things that really go across just about everywhere. You know, things that people want in the base mapping or whatever. Clearinghouse could be thrown up in here in this level too. Well, if we go down to shared functions, there seems like there could be a lot of things that might go up here. For example, ArcGIS server. I don't know how many agencies have ArcGIS server, several of them. But does everybody need one in their shop, or if one was in one central location that you could utilize those services transparently, just like it was down the hall, you know, could that work for you? Desktop licensing for our GIS, for example. We all do our own licensing right now. We don't have an enterprise license. Shelly and I work with the Office of Surface Mining through their TIPS program. And we can check out licenses through Denver or Pittsburgh over the internet for, you know, ArcGIS. And they have a whole list of the whole suite of ESRI products out there for us to tap into. So, you know, if you're out here and you need to use spatial analysts, you can pull a license down. Somebody's not using it. And so it's a matter of managing how many licenses do we need of each product. We make the whole product suite to everybody to use. So, you know, that works pretty well, as for us. There's other things we could put in there. I know Mr. Sid, we've got a Mr. Sid license over at our office. I think y'all have one at DEQ. I don't know if anybody else does or not. But we could stick that thing up on a network share kind of thing, and we could just use one license to do that kind of work. FME might be something. I don't know if anyone has FME or not. You've got it over there. You know, it's a pretty slick tool. Web services is another thing, you know, that we could all share with. ArcGIS server, you know, those web services coming out of there, OGC stuff. Application development. You know, here's another area that you might have people in your agency that are programmers. And they might, you know, and they have it, and they do geospatial type programming. And I look at that as something different than just some guy who built a web page. Because, you know, you've got to think spatially when you do some of this kind of stuff. So, you know, I would like to see, you know, these type folks in a group that we can all share and utilize their resources. Right now, I don't have anybody I can go to, you know, fix something that I need fixed, for example, in an application. Maybe that's because I haven't looked hard enough, I don't know. But I think they're around somewhere, but I don't know where they are. Spatial database administration, that's another kind of unique thing with regard to that, as opposed to just pure database. Support for small agencies. There's a lot of agencies in the state that could really utilize GIS, but they don't have anybody that can go out and help them right now. I mean, we've been working with some over, you know, on our part. Had an opportunity to work with, well, not directly with DCS, actually came from Representative Murphy. They had a spreadsheet that had almost 5,000 properties that they were trying to manage over there. And, you know, they had a cost associated with the majority of them. And, you know, how do you look at a spreadsheet with 5,000 buildings in it, make some sense out of it, where they are? Well, you know, you play with that for a while, you get it in the format of the database so that, you know, you can join it up with some other database that has cities in it, and you can eventually get some points on the map so you can say, well, in Tulsa, there's this many million dollars worth of assets there, and these agencies are responsible for it. So, you know, you can go out and you can work with agencies to help them leverage this technology to improve their business processes. And then training is another one. So, you know, shared services, I think, is something that just my mind makes a lot of sense. And then we've got the specific agency functions out there. GIS work, as well as the support, whatever your mission is. And then we get back to the issue about data stewardship. You know, transportation, they you know, keep track of all the roads in the state, all the highways and stuff. That's their deal. You know, we've got streams over here and water. So, you know, we all have our own specific things. David, you keep track of poultry houses and pig farms and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, we each have a specific functions that we do, and we need to be able to keep those within the agency and maintain those. So, this other thing that we're going to have to deal with probably eventually is this Office of Geographic Information sitting out there. Right now, it's in the Conservation Commission. Well, once this restructuring takes place, is that really the best place for it? I mean, does it need, can it, should it be somewhere else that would be more functional, be able to use the structure that's there to carry out some of these things? Well, I would submit to you that there is a place for it. That is different. This, again, I'm just basically reorganized some of the words on this pyramid to put our GIS things in there. But, you know, to me, my mind, this OGI fits right here in the shared service kind of category, in between kind of work across with agencies, and special projects, and work with small agencies, and so on. So, anyway, this is, I guess, my concept of how this IT governance could work. So, you know, that's what you guys tell me. And we don't have to solve this today. I just want to get this out to you. If you're thinking about it, you know, maybe next month we can come up with something. We could form a work group smaller than you know, 9 or less council members, along with other state agency people, to do this. You know, think through this, say this will work better this way or that way. Kind of however you all want to approach this. So, wish you any comments and any other thoughts.
Well, I read the one you sent out several documents, and I read through the one from NASIO, and I don't know if anyone else read that document, but on page 13 of that document, they outline ISGIP recommendations, and you know, it's right in line with what your thinking is. I think that in there does need to be the GI Council, you know, at that shared services level, and that group needs to actually also have coordination and control over the GIS functions in the individual agencies. So again, going back to talking about standards and so forth and governance, you know, what are we going to do? First slide, you know, what doing the right things the right way and so forth. So I guess I'd recommend that everybody read through this and ask you the document that Mike sent out. And then, as you said, you know, form a group that can get together and decide, you know, how does this need to be structured and so forth. And it sounds like through the legislation, I wasn't aware until I read your email and everything, that the legislation that does govern what you all do and so forth. So you already have some teeth there, I guess. Maybe you need some more, but.
Yeah. Even though a lot of people are doing GIS work, they're officially classified as that. I don't know if you can run and hide from this deal or not. You know, and from what I understand, from what Mr. Pettit said at the meeting we had on last Wednesday, is that whenever they did this study back in the fall, where they hired this Capgemini firm to come in and do all these surveys on IT with the agencies, and it wasn't a mandatory survey. I mean, like education, they didn't participate in the process, what I understand. But they tried to get a handle on IT resources out there, server, software, people doing IT work. Well, you know, if you go to OPM and ask how many people are in an IT type job classification, you come up with about 800 or so people. Well, the survey came back and said there's about 1,800 out there. Well, that's a pretty big spread, you know. Something's wrong. And so based on that, rather than what Alex phrased this, was that they initially thought they could normalize this whole process on shared services and just look at that. Cool. Thing together, but now they're going to sit down with each individual agency and look at what services you are currently receiving through OSF, what services they could provide for you, what services do you need that they're not providing that could, maybe down the road, and try to come up with a plan that will address those shared services needs. Then also look at what it is that you need to carry out your mission. In other words, if you need GIS people there that are, you know, doing GIS to you know, keep track of the roads and all that kind of stuff, then they would stay there the way I am doing this thing.
Right.
And so it's not like you're going to come and yank everybody out. You know, these agencies come under this large umbrella. So. I mean, I feel a lot better about the situation now than I did, you know, a couple of months ago. Just seeing what and hearing what's been said and discussed. So.
Yesterday we had a staff meeting in IT over at my agency, and our IT director came in to talk about the presentation by Mr. Pettit the day before yesterday. He basically emphasized several times that Mr. Pettit seemed to be very conciliatory and understanding toward all the agencies. Kept reassuring people, well, they said, of course, anytime it's emergency, they always say that no one's going to lose their job. Yes. But they also said that they want to leave people in the agencies who are needed, need to be there. Mm-hmm. I do see opportunities here, such as having ArcGIS, you know, for instance, ArcGIS server or whatever, you know, open source servers, you know, maintained at local location so that you don't necessarily have to have the expertise yourself to, because that's been one of the big resource drains on me personally is you know, operating, locating, or setting up ArcGIS server and SDK myself, and feeling like I'm kind of right at the edge of my capabilities of doing that and everything else, whereas it would be good to have somebody that's really dedicated whose job is to monitor that and be on top of it, and who's that's a big part of their job. Mm-hmm. Another thing is, I was looking at I talked to an organization called the Mares Mississippi Area Resource Information System back in the mid-90s, and they were they were well along with GIS and ArcInfo at that time, and they weren't some kind of GIS czar at all, but what they were is they were the agency in Mississippi that was most involved in GIS, and basically some agencies had their own GISs, but for others, Marist would give them advice on what to do. And for still other agencies, Marist was their GIS service provider. They just did everything for that agency. So, I mean, something like that could evolve here, where centralize what you can, leave there what you need to, and make things easier on the agencies that already have GIS going. Be a service provider for those agencies that are small and don't have the budget to do it on their things on the ground.
Now, there's some discussion about that in that Minnesota article that I sent out, where they talked about your more mature GIS people and doctors and all that kind of stuff. And you've got the group in the middle, and you've got the people on the other end that don't know what GIS means, stands for. Once you explain it to them and show them, the light bulb comes on, and they say, man, this is great. Well, the more people we have coming into our fold, if you will, and it just makes it better, because that means we can improve our services, spread the resources out to more people.
I know the legislative mandate, though, is to do all this to save money.
That's right.
And I'm not sure exactly where the cost savings will come in, unless there's something we can save on licensing, having a license server, like you were suggesting, where instead of buying individual copies of software, a license server that serves it out. Of course, those floating licenses cost twice as much. So that's the other side of that point. You have to make sure you have enough so people have the licenses for the
job.
I guess you get a lot of application.
Who's got more licenses than they can use?
Who does?
I said, who does? Who has more licenses out there than they can use? I mean,
like always, we've got 100 licenses sitting out there that tap in. When you teach a class, you see 20 of them go out. But still serving the whole country.
But that enterprise license agreement, like the ASRI. Maybe there's a cost savings.
Is there anything happening on that area? You don't
know? Shelley, do you want to say anything on that?
Sasha may actually know more about it than I do. I know that Michael Fanaro, who is our state rep, he has been in contact with Mr. Pettit and talking about that. I don't know that there's actually been any motion on that with all of this legislation and everything. Maybe waiting until that's all taken care of. But I do know that they've been in contact about not only a master purchasing agreement at this point rather than an enterprise license. So,
yeah, I think Shelley's right. I think that Mr. Pettit was wanting to see how a lot of this shook out before deciding which direction to go. Certainly in the past, the MPA, the Master Purchasing Agreement, was more popular. However, given the new mandates and the new potential structure that may be in place, an ELA probably makes a lot more sense. And certainly, there'd be cost savings in terms of pooling things together. Like right now, if someone has five licenses, they're paying maintenance on as if they just had five. Somebody over here is paying maintenance on as if they had five. If you put those together and you start looking at bulk types of situations, there could be savings in that respect.
I sent a copy of this presentation over to Mr. Evans to see what we were all going to see. Mr. Thrall is our agency director, and I have a meeting with Mr. Evans this afternoon. Michael's basically on the tour of the new bank facility, so we got that. Hopefully, I have a chance to visit with him a little bit about his thoughts on some of these issues, too.
I just would say one of the things that we're going to have to pay close attention to as well is in the legislation, there's no funding source for a lot of these ideas that they're bringing forward. So you have to understand that as they start identifying things that could be a common piece, whatever you're spending in your own budget, for certain things, that part of your budget will then be transferred over to this. And so all of a sudden your budgeting process is going to be drastically different, because now large chunks of your budget are going to be sent to a place to pay for the centralization of this.
And along that line, I haven't heard how services that are currently being funded with federal money, how that's going to be handled, this whole transition.
See, that's a huge thing.
That's a big thing, yeah. And for us, I mean, Shelley and I, we're totally 100% federal money. Our IT guy, he's half. So, you know, how do you transfer that with no money? I'm sure someone's thinking about that over there, but I haven't heard it, how it's going to shake out. So there's a lot of unknowns.
And something that the agency's going to have to look at is if there's a decision that certain things will be the centralized platform that may not be, you know, relevant to your agency. All of a sudden, you could be looking at an overall retraining cost to, you know, retrain your people into a different way.
Yeah, I hope that's not the case. It certainly sounds like, listening to Mr. Pettit, that he's going to try to work with whatever the things are that you need to make it work. The example he gave was, and this has to go back with CORE, okay? I don't know how familiar you all are with CORE, but I've heard a lot from our agency people about the problems they've had. The way Mr. Pettit explained the way things have kind of been done in the past was that, you know, you go into a restaurant and expect, you know, you've got something on the menu and it's only one thing. It's like fried chicken and duck pepper. You sit down there and you say, oh, I don't like fried chicken and duck pepper. Too bad. $20 we're charging today for that. Well, you come in the next day and it's meatloaf and a Diet Coke. I can't stand Diet Coke. Yeah, too bad. You know, $20. So you take it or leave it. Well, you can't leave, but you got to take it. So he said, we're not going to operate that way. At least that's the impression I got from, you know, we're trying to make fit this to where you guys do work and make this thing work for you. That's been my take on this.
And one could hope, you know, that that's the way. But anytime I see the legislature exempt themselves from something, usually means it's because that it has some of those elements to it.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, you know, they exempted themselves from our statutes that we got in place in 2004 around standards and all that. So.
It's the same old story. You know, legislature exempts themselves, higher education exempts themselves, and every, you know, that's just the rest of them out there to fit for themselves. But, you know, it's one of those deals. I think it's coming. It's coming. So I think, you know, we're all scared of it, but if we get on board and work together, at least we can have a chance to help guide. We have not steer, but, you know, guide where it's going.
Well, definitely, you know, importance on that data governance, you know, to set up a system that they understand that, you know, when it comes to, you know, this kind of data, you know, these people are the ones that need to be responsible for it. Right. These are the people you need to talk to about it, and they're the ones that need to maintain it. And so that way, all of that data doesn't get shifted and try to be maintained in some other fashion.
I agree. It's, you identify stewards of data, they are responsible for that data. And that's just the way it is. That's it. Okay, well, we've used up a good time when we need to let Dave make his presentation. So if that's okay, we'll move on and see how this thing goes. So, next, we've got Billy McPherson. He's from the Center for Spatial Analysis. He's been working on this climate work down there, and he's going to talk to us about the Southern Climate Impact Planning Support System that he's been developing. So.
case you're wondering. Mark Lohman. Yes. My name is Billy McPherson, as already mentioned. I think a little, just a quick background into myself so you see how I fit into this project. I have a physics degree from back in the 80s, a long time ago. A meteorology degree from the 90s. Got into working at the Oklahoma Climatological Survey, doing meteorological types of work, climate work, a lot of programming, and working with a lot of different projects. And so, eventually I moved over to CSA where I worked on a project where we were siting a whole bunch of climate automated sites across the country using some multi-criteria decision analysis. That project ended. Now I'm on with this other project. And NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, has a lot of regional climate interest. And they put together some research centers and some operational centers. Some of the research centers are, well, ours, as you'll see, it's called SCIP, the Southern Climate Impacts Planning Program. And it covers a nice six-state region, which is a little bit hard to see, but it's Oklahoma, Texas, Arkansas, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Tennessee. The reason it covers that six-state region is because our partner is the Southern Regional Climate Center, which is located at LSU, and that's their state region, or their six-state region. That's the operational center that I was mentioning. So our center as a research center corresponds to their center as an operational center. Okay. So the main units that are involved in putting this together are the Oklahoma Climatological Survey at OU and Department of Geography and Anthropology at Louisiana State. That's where most of the employees at the Southern Climate Center are located. And of course, we've got the National Weather Center in OU that's also part of this. So what are we doing? Well, we're basically trying to create at least a portal, but hopefully some tools to let people prepare for climate hazards. Okay? More stuff. We want to take a multi-hazards approach to this. We don't want to just focus on a few hazards, but we want to take everything that we can put under the umbrella of climate and bring those in and help get this information out to people. And we want to do that through what we call the Southern Climate Impacts Planning Support System, or SCIPS. So we have SCIP, and we have SCIPS, which is made by SCIP. Okay, so we want some interactive GIS visualization, and we want the decision makers to be able to come in and use the tools we provide them to make good decisions, to help plan for the future. I mean, this is climate, okay? We're not weather-focused. We're not looking at what tornadoes are about to hit me. We're looking at what's happened in the past, how likely is it going to happen in the future. So we're trying to bring together all these different data sets. The most difficult one so far, and the only one we've really gotten working, I guess we took the hardest one first, was the severe storm reports. These reports come from the Weather Service, from the National Climate Center. They collect them from all the local weather services. They make sure they're correct, and then I don't know what they do. They induce some errors, because when we get them, they're not all correct. Okay, so we have to go through and figure out what all is going wrong. And you'll get to see a little bit, it'll become apparent, some of the weirdness that goes on in this. There's also the Applied Climate Information System at LSU, and they keep track of all the cooperative data that's been collected for over a century now. So there's a lot of sites out there that have a long history of data. So we're trying to integrate that data too. So who are our users, or our planned users anyway? People we're targeting are the kinds of people that are trying to make decisions about their city, their municipal area, their county, whatever, but don't have historically the funds to do so. So a lot of towns say they're trying to go out and get some sort of FEMA grant, get storm ready or whatever. A lot of them will hire consultants who will go around sifting through all the data, putting together these reports for them so they can send them in. So spending a whole lot of money for letting somebody else do the work. Well, you know, that's fine if that's what they want to do, but a lot of places can't do that. Lexington can't do that. Noble can't really do that. Norman, yeah, we can do that. Oklahoma City, absolutely, they can do it, no problem. But what about these places, Lexington's, the Nobles, the Marlows, they can't do that. Where do they get their data from? How do they put it together? How do they make it look? So what we want to do is to try and help them, at least in these climate issues, be able to bring this data together. I'm showing you drought here. This is the drought index image from 8th of July 2008. If you've seen anything recently, that brighter red extends up and around us. So we are in a D3 drought, which is considered extreme. But this was a pretty bad drought going on in Texas and also some in Tennessee. So this is the main tool that Skip was sold on, or I should say the main data type that we want to present. Skip was sold on being a drought management tool. Broader sense, a tool for understanding water resources from the climate point of view. Okay, drought's one side of the coin, flooding and just your normal rainfall is the other side. And so, what are the types of products we might want to look at? Well, since we've got the drought monitor, we might want to look at how often were we above a certain drought level in that year. You can see down there in south central Texas, they were almost in drought the entire year, at least at D1 level. Go looking through these at different levels, and you can get a feel for the type of drought that you're in. How might somebody actually use this? We're not sure yet. That's going to be one of our next steps. This, if I have my way about it, this is going to be the next tool that I get to make. Right now, we're not at that stage. Let me go on just real fast. Because of the six-state area we have, another major tool is going to be a hurricane tool. The kind of thing where you can look at a hurricane, which is in the bright cyan there, that might go through Louisiana, and what types of infrastructure might it interact with? What might it blow over? In this particular case, the bright dots that are highlighted are dams. So this is the kind of tool that somebody could look at, and they could say, oh, this hurricane affected this infrastructure. A more interesting tool would be, what if I took this same hurricane, moved it over here, now what are we affecting? How might that affect me? That's something we've experimented with, and eventually that's a tool that I think we're going to have, because I've already built it in a sense within ArcMap. I just need to get it now on the web. So what are we doing then on the web? Let's go back to mirror mode here for just a moment. Instead of trying to make a live demonstration, I just made a movie of everything I would have done if I had done a live demonstration. So we've got a tool here. Starts out in the multi-state area. You can see it's doing zooming, panning, the types of things you'd expect a tool to do. In case you're wondering, this is built in the ArcGIS API for JavaScript. And have anybody here worked with any of those APIs? I mean, they made life a whole lot easier. We were trying to do things straight out of ArcGIS server with the ADF, which should have been a curse word, actually. This is beautiful. So, we're using JavaScript. This is a website. The JavaScript's embedded into this with some tools put together by Esri. They packaged it on top of what's called Dojo, which is another great little package of tools to program in JavaScript. So, just to give you an idea, this is our prototype tool. We've got a lot of the information on the left pane. That pane I anticipate going away. The tools will be menus that will come up and go away as you need them, because one of the things we found out from the focus groups we've had so far is give us more space for the map. So I've already ripped out the footer. It'll eventually fix so the left side will go away, and all we'll have is a short little header at the top and map everywhere. Okay, so let's go look at the Amarillo area. So using just the regular click and drag tool, we're now into Amarillo. And I don't know if you noticed it, but one of the things that happened was there was a little text at the left that told you to zoom in or order to see the information. It's gone away now, meaning now we can click on these boxes and see what's up there. So let's look at hail. That's one of the three severe weather types that we're looking at. And turn on wind. Now, this is something I want you to notice about, again, the data types that we're using. Hail and wind reports apparently only occur along roadways. Yeah, I know. It's incredible. Who would have thought that? Well, it makes sense because this is a very sparse part of the country. Okay. One afternoon, I spent like a week of my life driving across the Texas Panhandle, which is about how it feels. And so there just aren't the reports. There's a lot of reports that are missing that have actually occurred. Many times the reports will come in and the Weather Service office is trying to verify a thunderstorm. Okay, they've issued a thunderstorm warning. So what they want to know is, did we get any hail 1 inch or bigger? Did we get any wind 50 knots, which is about 58 miles per hour, or greater? So they wait for the reports to come in. And when they get that report, they're very busy with severe weather going on, okay? People's houses blowing over, all sorts of things happening. They may not really take in the rest of the reports. More may come, but they don't always get logged. And many times the people don't know where they were. It also just happens that all reports happen to the nearest hundredth of a degree, okay? That's another great facet of what's going on here. So many times, if they just know you're in a city, it gets set at the latitude, longitude of the local post office. So most reports happen at post offices. Yeah, so what are we trying to even show here? Well, when you look at it, it's nice to see everything on the map, but you're going to want also some idea of how many did you really have in an area. Okay, so we'll be getting to that in just a minute. Next thing we'll do is we'll actually turn on the tornadoes here. As soon as I quit mousing around in the middle here. And again, we have tracks and we have points. That's because some tornadoes we only get the touchdown point. We don't know anything about the track. And sometimes I don't even believe these tracks anyway. They're awfully straight because we only have 2 points. And we know they move around a lot in between. But that's the best data we have. So we use it. We have the ability to just clear out all the layers at once. And because this gets really messy, if you have everything turned on and zoomed out a long way, I turn it back off. Okay, and again, we get that text that's saying, says you have to zoom in order to see the severe weather display. So we're going to do that. Central Oklahoma, and we'll go back in and we turn on the tornadoes again. And there's all the tornadoes for Central Oklahoma for the period of record 1955 to, in this case, 2009. You can click on the map and you can look at a particular location and see what's there. There were no wind or hail events where I happened to click, but there were 6 tornadoes that were right under the mouse, able to go through and highlight them and actually show which tornado goes with that record. Okay. Also, one of the great things that we're able to do, and it's something that's just built in to the API, is create a base map gallery so that we can go in and swap out all these different base maps. So I was able to put up a topography base map. This one's an imagery with some labels on top of it. And then, of course, we've got the street map that I've been showing up here so far. And, of course, I have to choose colors of the severe weather events that are going to at least be able to be seen. Okay, now this is the part that's most important. This is the part where people want to query an area and find out what's in their area. Right now, we give three ways to do that query. We'll get up to that in just a moment. But we also can limit what's going on. We can turn on what I call damage reports. Remember I say the wind is only severe if it's 50 knots or greater. But there are a lot of reports that just say damage. And that's all we have. You can include those if you want to click them on. I don't want to include those. You can pick a minimum wind speed, a minimum hail size, minimum fatalities, injuries, F-scale of the tornado, a date range. And if you happen to pick something that's too low, for example, if I try to set 45, you're going to get an error message that says, you can't go below 50, please try again. Okay, so now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to set a buffer size, and I'm going to click on a point. And what it's going to do is zoom into that buffer, that point, plus 10 miles, and get all the data for that particular area. So any tornado, hail, wind event that intersected that area, it'll come up and find. We can also do the same thing for urban areas. Notice it'll clear out when I just click on this. And these areas are defined by the National Weather Service. It's what they use in their AWIPS system. They have gone through and put in all their own GIS information, which is moderately close to what's going on, except you saw that hole in Norman that still thinks Hall Park is a city of its own, which it isn't anymore. But that's okay. The thing is, what if you really are interested in a little bit more than just your area? You say to yourself, just because a tornado didn't come through, if it missed us by a mile or 2 miles, shouldn't I be looking at that and seeing, you know, what's the greater threat? What's the higher probability? You know, more events you get, the more better your probabilities work. So we can put a buffer in there if we want to. So this is 5 miles around Norman. And you get a lot more events. We can also query by county, and I'm going to put a 2 mile buffer in here, and we're going to look at Oklahoma County because that's where we are today. So let's see what we've got historically within 2 miles of Oklahoma County. Lots of stuff. That again is from like 1950 or 1955 through 2009. And again, we can do things like zoom in, zoom out. Eventually, what I want to be able to do is to go in here, change out the cascading style sheets within this website so that it will resize itself down to a size suitable for printing. Because printing is a big thing people want to do. And if you try and print this right now, this is this is really the way it's supposed to work in the Esri API. We're looking at set scales here. Okay, you can't get the in-between scales. So if I change the size of the window, it's not going to resize that map that's inside there. It's going to keep it at that same scale and just make the window around it smaller. So you may not be around what you're trying to look at anymore. People who are trying to print, that really upsets them. They want to see what they want to see, not what you give them. So in that case, I'll have to put in some sort of resizing and in the CSS, and that's where we're going. That's turning out to be a majorly difficult process. You will notice there's some other buttons down there besides map. Oh, yeah, right. Again, we can turn on and off the different imagery underneath the selections. But let's go look now at some tables, because we can also represent the data in different table formats. As you see, we have tornado, wind, and hail. Okay? So we can look at all of these in their own table, set in their own tabs. It's a nice little table because it's just something that Dojo gives us for free. It lets me go in and resort the data based on any of these. So there's the hail, the greatest hail size, which happens to be 5 inches for this area one time. And then we can go back and sort whatever. We can also go in here and download the table data. At least that much is working. So you've gotten all your information. You want to see, okay, I want to get this down and look at it in my own spreadsheet. So you can do that. But I have to tell you, putting this button in was one of the hardest things I have had to do in this whole entire site, because it kept overwriting either the graphs or the graphs overwrote the button. And I thought I was going to pull what hair I had left out of my head. But there it is, the data. You're able to get it. You're able to put it in your own spreadsheet. If you wanted to, you could also pull it into ArcMap and look at it there on your own. Eventually, we'll be able to go in and you'll be able to download the actual data that was selected. It'll just bundle it up in a zip file. Here we have graphs. Another nice feature that's in the Dojo. We're looking at the tornadoes and time of day. So what we first saw was at 15, which is 3 o'clock. These are all central daylight time. We had, I can't remember how many tornadoes. Anybody catch what that number was when it was like? It was something bigger than this. 3 hours later, we have 13 tornadoes that have been recorded at that time. And here at the 9 to 10 o'clock time period, we had even more. This is if we're looking at all the tornadoes by month now. You can see that the most happened in May. There's April at 14. May is 41. Well, that makes sense. We get most of our tornadoes in the month of May. Okay. And by hour, or I'm sorry, by date, 1974 was when we got the most, 8. 86, 7, and then several years where we got 5. That was the May 3rd tornado. 5 came through just a few years ago in 2008. And then in 2003, right about the time my wife was trying to graduate with a degree and we're trying to keep her parents all satisfied, and they're scared of tornadoes and all this other stuff, which just sort of pain. Okay, wind by year. You can see where some of those occurred. Hail by year, you can see again where those occurred. So let's go back and look at the tornadoes by month. I love looking at these things. Okay, so it had a maximum in May. Okay, that's great. Wind also has a maximum in May, but look how many more events happened during the summer. There's different kinds of thunderstorms that occur during the summer that are not tornado producers, but when they collapse, they produce all sorts of wind events. The hail, on the other hand, mimics the tornadoes. They need the same types of storms to form hail that you get to form tornadoes. Okay. So these are the kinds of things that we're putting into place for the city planners, water planners, whoever, to come in and look at. And like I say, this is the very first tool. We'll be looking at drought, we'll be looking at hurricane, we'll be hopefully finding a way to look at ice storms, because that data doesn't exist, so we'll have to find some sort of proxy. But everything else, we're just trying to put it all in. Some places have already created really nice sites for looking at and getting this data. Like the Coastal Services Center of NOAA has put together an excellent hurricane tool. So now we have to think, are we wanting to become a portal and we point people to it, but then they don't get the same kind of information necessarily that they were wanting to put together in the first place. So we don't know if we're doing them a service by just pointing them somewhere else, or if we really do need to sort of reinvent the wheel, but not completely, because we really need something else. So these are all the issues we're tackling right now. We still have a few more years of the first initial funding to do this, so we're doing okay. Any questions?
I have a question.
Yes.
On your map of Oklahoma City, for example, where you had all the tornado lines coming through, the red lines, did you have the capability to click on one of those lines and see what year that was?
Yes. Another one of the reasons I want to get rid of that left pane is so that I have to use for other things. And in this case, I would rather, instead of the table being on a totally different section, I would like the table to pop up over there so that you'd be able to scroll through those, click on any of those, find the event, or click on the event and have it pull up on the table, which one you look at. So, yes, that is a plan.
Yeah.
As far as that is. Other questions? Time for lunch, isn't it?
Do you have, is this accessible to the public?
Not yet. It will be in the near future in a demonstration mode. We're being research in this sense. We're not trying to create the operational tool ourselves. And so while we do want to make it available, it won't be operational. It'll be demonstrationable, whatever you want to call it. Yeah. And then eventually we hope that we get this tool in a good enough shape that some NOAA organization that is more operational, say the Southern Climate Center at LSU, would take it over. But it will be available before then. It just is not available today. Probably sometime, maybe this summer. At least for this first part of the tool. We'll bring the parts on as we get them finished. Or even maybe before we get them finished. You know, we might bring this tool on even with that left pane in there like it is now, even though I hate it. But, you know, it's still useful to some people. So, that's our goal.
I think the insurance company might, or industry might take a look at this and see how they might use it.
They might. Insurance people are kind of funny that way. Well, they have a lot of ideas of their own. At least in Oklahoma, Dr. Mark Schaefer, who's at the Climate Survey, who put this whole project together because he was answering these types of questions all the time, he thought, we should just put the data somewhere everybody can get it. He has also worked a lot with the insurance industry here in Oklahoma, putting together seminars, workshops, those types of things. So my guess is he has talked to them in some respect to Skip and the types of things they might need. They might not need a tool as much as they need other types of research, but you know, it's up to them.
Many of them are already doing this, something similar to this on their own.
You know, you click on a 1 mile radius around my house and you see all those red lines and green dots. Well, maybe we need to raise your
Yeah, exactly.
They have a lot of this, though. I mean, like, they also have the lightning data, which we'll hopefully put in there one day. And, you know, they're able to see how often your house gets struck by lightning, which, you know, really, it doesn't happen. But it happens nearby and causes fires and those types of things. So we work with them, but not necessarily through this.
Yes. When this is operational, how up to date will it be? How do you envision? I think you showed 208 here.
It will be dependent on each data type. For example, the drought information comes out weekly. So we could conceivably update that weekly. Okay. The weather information comes out of NCDC in a bundled format once per year. So somewhere around mid-year, you get the previous year. So in mid-2010, we got the 2009 data. That's why we're only up to 2009. In a couple of months, we'll get last year's data. We'll bring that in. There are other forms of data which are a little bit more real-time, and they come from what's called the local storm reports. And these are reports that they have not gone through and checked, but are available up to real time. You know, pretty much yesterday's data is made available sometime the day after. So we could conceivably have more current data for even the severe weather. hurricane data happens for each hurricane. So it's not a unified data set in the way that we get it and have to put it into something else. The ACES data, which I was talking about, which is the climate data, it's updated as soon as those reports come in. So for weather service sites, they come in daily. For the co-op observer sites, they send in their observations once a month. So it just really depends. It's going to be pseudo real time, in a sense, when the tool is finished. We won't try to keep it up to date fully, but within a couple of weeks, we hope to have as much of the climate in there as possible. But again, we're trying to look at things from a historic perspective as opposed to a weather event perspective. So it's the kind of tool that doesn't have to be as up to date as other things. That's not to say we aren't going to try, but. Anyone else?
How has FEMA taken and utilized your information? I know dealing with hazard mitigation plans, if you have a plan in place before disaster comes in, it's a whole lot easier to get things ramped up with FEMA.
Right.
We've done a lot of the exact same things with hazards years and years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I look at it this and go, wow, that'd been a whole lot easier.
Yeah.
A lot easier.
Yeah, well, that's the point. In talking to some of these cities that do try and do it themselves, they would call Mark Schaefer and say, hey, can you show me this? And so he put together, or one of the other people at OCS would put together a map, send it to them, like in a PDF, or even have to mail it to them, depending on what kind of systems they have. And that got old. And so this is the kind of information, right, that we would like to be able to put into a FEMA report. So we are looking at the FEMA reports and trying to see what
I was curious if you could actually take this data and dump it straight into a FEMA report and have it set in there for them in their format.
Yes. That is a goal. That's what we want to do.
Very nice.
Yeah. And, of course, just from the climate perspective.
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
If you've got that stuff in place, it's a lot easier for FEMA to come in and give you assistance a lot faster.
Yes.
Right.
Or to get that grant to build up your system.
You know, whatever.
Okay, what else before I get dizzy here?
So you're using ArcGIS.com for all the base maps?
Yes.
That's pulling it. And then the more local data, the tornado paths, the hail events, is that, you have that published through future services?
We're running 931.
Got it.
And they're just either layers or they are inquiries.
Oh, okay.
I am hoping to use the feature services of version 10 because they will let me do some things that I can't quite do yet. Also, I'll be able to do some really nice things with temporal aspects of the data that I cannot do under 9. Yeah, so, I have big plans, I just can't get to them fast enough. Anyone else? Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, man. Okay, next item is GIS discussion or any data issues anyone might have.
That's a program FEMA, USGS, NOAA, and the ag agencies did an inventory of enhanced elevation data across the country. Their primary focus is LIDAR data, but they're also looking at high-res photogrammetrically derived elevation data. There was a federal inventory that was done back in the fall. All the liaisons were asked from each state were asked to validate the inventory that was done for their state. So I kind of been working with the validation of the Oklahoma inventory. They sent us a map that showed the elevation data for Oklahoma, and then I had to go to those agencies to validate the records that was associated with that block information for that particular project. And that validation phase of the inventory has been completed. The next phase is going to be an interview phase, and we've been waiting for approval from OMB, Office of Management and Budget, to proceed with that. And so we did get that approval. I was very shocked. I thought they would disapprove that in the budget climate they were in, because the objective of this whole project, it goes back a couple of years, but it's, the goal is to provide concrete benefits to OMB to show, to justify a nationwide LIDAR / IRAS elevation program. But the second phase of that is this interview phase, and this is the state, local, tribal part of the NEO process. And in that process, we have to pick a state champion, and I've asked Mike if he would be that state champion. And then we have to go and identify tribes, state agencies, and local governments that will participate in the interview phase. And so that is the next phase that's going to be happening, and that should be happening in May sometime. We're going to have a meeting next week, and they're going to give us some more information about that. But the interview phase involves, they're going to, once we identify the champion and the agencies that will participate, that agree to participate, there will be a survey put out on the website. Those agencies will go and complete the survey, and then they will, the liaisons will either have a focus group meeting or work with those agencies, liaison and the champion, and review the information they provided in the survey to make sure that all the information is correct, you know, and it's well-defined. But if somebody may say we achieved great benefits, part of the survey would be what were those benefits specifically, you know, to get detailed information about that. So that is going on. Dewberry is a contractor that's actually working with USGS to provide a report that will go to OMB, I think, in the June time frame. So I just wanted to let everybody know that was happening, especially since we've gotten approval from OMB that we will be going into the interview phase coming up now.
So, Darrell, would it be appropriate for people that are interested in participating in this survey to let me know so that,
yes,
identify those folks that either use this enhanced data or have an interest in it?
I don't want to exclude anybody that want to participate, so I think that's a good idea. But one of the things they told us is that we don't want to get a whole bunch of folks, because the survey and the subsequent phases of that are pretty robust and could be time-consuming, and it's more time-consuming on the back end. So I'm not sure how, you know, at some point we got to identify those people that participate. We definitely want people that use LIDAR, are familiar with LIDAR, the benefits and the trade-offs. So you don't want to get, one of the things, you don't want to get managers too high up in the organization that don't know the details. You don't want to get people too low in the organization that don't know the details of the managerial aspects of project management. So, but yes, that would be appropriate, I think.
So the way this will eventually be used is to maybe to support a national LIDAR effort?
Yes, exactly. That's the plan. But one of the benefits, you know, it wasn't something I look forward to doing, but one of the benefits of it is we do have an Oklahoma graphic that shows, we can't release it yet, of course, all of this is still in the works and part of the report, but we do have, we will have an Oklahoma inventory that shows where LIDAR and this high-res elevation information is available across the state. And you know, certain agencies get LIDAR every year or that about. So as that happens, we can include them in the inventory also. So that'll be a good thing to try to keep that inventory updated as we move forward.
So if anyone's interested in participating in the survey, it sounds like there's going to be a time commitment down the road on this. Let's show their ID. See if we can get you up here. Anybody else? I'll just mention that there's some legislation going through House Bill 1086. It's passed the House. It's in the Senate Appropriations Committee right now. But it has a section in it that talks about the Oklahoma State Geographic Information One-Stop Initiative. Basically telling the state information coordinator to develop and maintain an online web presence to allow public to get access to geodata. Supposed to promulgate procedures by which a state agency, board, commission, and public trust to having the state of Oklahoma as a beneficiary shall submit geodata to the Office of Geographic Information to be published on a maps.oklahoma.gov website. And they define geodata as mean information which can be presented as a component of a geographic or spatial presentation. So pretty broad. So the way I think that thing comes to be, it's going to actually put a lot of work, I think, on the council to actually look at standards and core data and that sort of thing. So, you know.
HB what?
Pardon?
HB what? Which house?
1086. House Bill 1086 is by Representative Murphy.
What was the impetus behind that, Mike? Why?
Oh, they're creating all these different data.gov entities out here to get information out to the public. I think that's, and Dick Dionne, you've got a
transparency,
yeah. And you know, we've talked about in here before about the need to have a kind of authoritative data source that people can go to, you know, with metadata. And in some of my discussion with Representative Murphy, I explained to him that's what we try to do as a council is to have authoritative sources of data. That's what we hope to get into with the data stewardship. Have metadata with data so people understand what's the quality of it, how they can use it, and that sort of thing, rather than somebody just posting a data set out here on the web saying, here's fire stations, for example. How was that made? Those sort of things. So I think that's part of this.
Is there going to be any money come with this, or just...
I haven't seen any. I doubt it.
Okay, the next question is, if this is envisioning using the website that you guys have developed, is there going to be any mechanism to modify that as you go forward?
That's the other question.
Yeah.
It's like everything else. We have all these things to do,
but
no problems.
But I'm hesitant to be all in favor of a rubber stamp on something if there's no mechanism in place to update it with the new metadata or extra sources of data or such. There's no money in the kitty for that.
Is there a way to go talk to the Senate and say, bring that whole Palatine question to the table? I mean, you're already an unfunded, you have no funding at all right now.
Right. We have no funding at all, and it's just getting worse.
You're assuming they care.
But yeah, we intend to have that discussion. It's down to the office. Yeah. All right. Time's getting late. Any new business? Any meeting announcements that we need to bring up?
I did have a gentleman from the OGITA. They're having a conference on April 28th and 29th at the Reed Center, and I put flyers out here. It's about GIS and information technology for public entities. It is a free conference. They do ask that you register by April 21st. If you're a private industry that would like to participate, please contact Neil Gray. All of his contact information is in there. He said he had, I think he said, close to 60 different vendors that are going to be there. So he really wanted GIS and IT people to be to participate in this. So if you have any questions, feel free to contact me, and I can give you Neil's contact information.
The only other thing I have is I just got back late last night from our National GIS for Transportation Conference. And it's amazing in this economic climate. You know, everything's kind of tough, and we still ended up with 327 people at this conference. GIS is still, you know, the primary thing that people want to be able to learn about. And we were happy about it. And 35 DOTs had two international DOTs. It worked out really good. And we've already started planning. Next year is going to be our 25th anniversary for the conference. And it will be in Colorado, which should be close. And next week I'm finalizing Jack Dangerman will be our keynote. So just kind of let everybody know that it's coming back on the side of the Mississippi again.
Okay,
thanks.
Okay. Next meeting, I guess we're looking at May the 6th, Friday, first Friday. Gentleman from McCurtain County is in front and talked to us about a project that they've been working on building local data down there. We should talk about this too. This is a, talk about local data is the best data. We just want to make sure it's built right first time. You know, I think that's the key there, that all standards. Maintain quality data and consistent. So anyway, Robert Rowley will be here. This project is sponsored, I think, through the Ag Econ Department at OSU. And I know he's pretty excited about coming up and telling us about what they've done. So looking forward to that. Just to let you know, if you got some thoughts on this governance issue, feel free to call me or send me an email. Your thoughts about where we need to go, we need to put a work group together. Clock's ticking on this. July 1st, we're all supposed to pass. Anyway, I'll entertain a motion to adjourn.
I was going to say, real quick, today is the last day to sign up for the regional SCOG conference in San Antonio. Registration will be turned off this weekend. Monday morning, we're cranking up down there. And then also, April the 26th at Edmond. We generally have a user group meeting somewhere in Broken Arrow early in the year. With all the snow and everything, that one went away. We're going to go up to Edmond, and there's going to be a presentation by Pamela Kirsch with Esri, the mobile mapping, some of the neat aspects that we use with recent events. And then also, I believe, some of Sarah Cobb's people are going to have some presentations. So April 26th, we'll have an online registration up and going. It's free. We'll have that up and going the next couple of weeks.
Thanks. Entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Second.
Seconded. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Thank you all very much for coming. We are adjourned.